This is Audible.
The Ember Blade by Chris Wooding. Read by Simon Bubb.
1. Keep faith and hold fast, and we will free our land. Edric had said that not 3 days past, as he stood on the battlements of the keep at Salt Fork and watched the enemy closing in. Side by side with his brothers and sisters, pride swelling his chest and angry defiance in his eye, it had felt like truth. He knew better now. The forest whipped and scratched him as he clambered up a muddy slope, breath burning his lungs and a cold fist of terror in his gut. Dirk laboured through the undergrowth in his wake, white with exhaustion. The older man was at the limit of his endurance. It was plain by his slumped shoulders and the vacant look in his eyes. Edric hauled him the last few paces to the top, where Dirk bent over, pulling in air like a man near drowned. He scanned the forest fearfully while his companion recovered. The trees were loud with birdsong, dewed leaves stirring in the dawn light. There was no sign of their pursuers yet, but he could hear the Emperor's hounds through the trees. "You go on," Dirk said raggedly. He had the flat stare of a dead man. "I'm done." Edric had known Dirk for less than a season, and liked him for none of it. He was a low sort, fond of drink and spitting, and the kind of rough humour that made Edric uncomfortable. Edric was a frustrated young man with lordly blood, looking for a way to define himself. Dirk was an illiterate ironmonger with nothing left to lose. But Salt Fork had brought them together, united them in common cause. Even when everything lay in ruins, Edric wouldn't let go of that. He pulled Dirk upright. "You'll run," Edric said, "and when you can't, I'll carry you." Together, they stumbled on. He'd always known Salt Fork would be the end of him, but he'd dreamed a different end than this. 50 of them had seized that town, 50 who dared to stand against their oppressors. Their act of defiance was to be the spark that would ignite the fire of rebellion in their people. He never expected to survive, but at least his name would be remembered in glorious song. The bards would sing a different tune now. They'd sing of how the townsfolk's resistance crumbled as soon as the Crodan army came into sight, how the crowds threw open the gates and tried to arrest the men and women who'd led them astray, hoping to trade them for Crodan mercy. They'd sing of a shambolic escape through smugglers' tunnels, with the ringleaders fleeing for their lives as the soldiers marched in. They'd sing of failure, and they'd sing it in the tongue of their overlords. He'd seen Wren swallowed by the mob he was trying to reason with. Ella had died defending him, killed by a stone to the head. He didn't know if any of the others had survived. In the confusion, he'd lost everyone but Dirk. Perhaps there'd be a rendezvous days from now, some message left at a dead drop, but he wouldn't be there to read it. The Emperor's huntsmen had chased them through the night and drew closer with every hour. They wouldn't see another sunset, and both of them knew it. A temple loomed suddenly from the trees, towering before them. The sight of it brought them to a halt. Its walls had been breached by the forest, and a mossy cupola lay in ruins near the entrance. Balconied domes and soaring vaults had been gnawed bare by time's appetite, yet still it stood in testament to its makers, an elegant masterpiece from a lost world. Dirk's legs shook, and he fell to his hands and knees. Edric stared wide-eyed. Exhaustion had drained him of emotion, even his fear had been numbed. But now he felt a sense of wonder which slowed his hammering heart. Once his people had been great. They'd led the world in art, theatre, medicine, architecture, philosophy, astronomy, and the ways of war. Their empire had spanned the known lands, and Ossia had been the home of heroes. But that was the past, and the past was long behind them. Their empire had faded centuries before. Ossia had been under a Crodan boot for 30 years now, longer than Edric had been alive. He'd never known true freedom, and so, in the end, he'd gone searching for it. The collapse of the Salt Fork uprising, and the long and frantic night that followed, had shaken his faith. He'd cursed himself over and over for staking his life on a naive dream of revolution. Yet here, before this silent monument, he found new strength. The blood of its builders still ran in his veins, and one day his people would cast off their chains. "On your feet!" He hauled Dirk back up, though the man was a dead weight. "Leave me to the worms," he wheezed. "The red-eyed child comes for me." Edric pointed to the temple, where a dark doorway gaped amid a tangle of vines. "If we must die, it will be with the Nine at our backs, in the house of our ancestors." "The Nine," Dirk said bitterly. "Where are they now?" "They're still here," said Edric, his jaw tight. "This is their land. It is our land, and it will be again."
"You're a fool and a dreamer, Edric," Dirk said. "I always thought so."
Then his mouth twitched at the corner.
"We needed more like you."
The arrow hit Dirk with enough force to knock him to the ground. He fell face down, a thick shaft fletched with ragged black feathers in his back. Edric stared at him stupidly for a moment, dazed by the speed of his death. Then terror took hold, and he drew his sword, backing towards the temple, searching the trees for the enemy. He found only stillness and an uncanny silence. Even the birds had fallen quiet. Something was out there, a presence that iced his spine. The leaves hissed in the wind, and the very forest seethed with evil. He ran, springing up the temple steps two at a time, and reached the top before his leg gave way beneath him in an explosion of pain. He crashed down on the flagstones, sword skidding from his grip, clutching at his thigh where the barbed and bloody tip of an arrow poked out. Veins stood stark in his throat as he screamed. Numbness and corruption spread from the arrow, tendrils of foulness worming into his flesh that froze and burned all at once. He tried to rise and screamed again as the shaft moved inside his leg. His head spun, and everything was suddenly dim and distant. Through the fog that clouded his eyes, he glimpsed a soft red light inside the temple. A light in that long abandoned place where he'd seen only darkness before. He was seized by a desperate hope. Was there somebody in there who could save him? Here, in this sacred place, had the aspects sent him a sign? Gasping with the pain, he dragged himself inch by excruciating inch over the threshold. The forest had choked up the windows and shadows clustered thickly between the columns. Overhead, birds shifted quietly in their roosts among the stonework, subdued by the same dread that had silenced the others outside. Statues loomed at the edge of the darkness, barely more than lumps, hands lost and faces smooth. He recognized them anyway. There was Johar, the Heron King. There was brutish, squat Meshuk, Stone Mother. There, jaws agape and straining at his chains, was Azra the Despoiler, Lord of War. Edric offered a silent prayer to the Nine Aspects as he pulled himself over cracked flagstones, each movement sending fresh fire from the wound in his thigh. A set of steps led deeper into the dark temple. The source of the red glow was somewhere below. There was no sound from his pursuers, but he dared not hope this ancient place could keep his enemies out. He focused on the next lurch forward, and the next, until he reached the top of the steps. The red glow illuminated the bases of the columns beyond, but its source remained out of sight, hidden by the broken pieces of a toppled statue. With dry mouth and trembling arms, he slithered down the first step and the second. At the third, his elbow gave way, and he went tumbling and sliding out of control. The arrow in his thigh caught on an edge and wrenched sideways, and the pain which followed drove him into the black waters of unconsciousness. When he surfaced again, he was lying on his back at the foot of the steps, his head tipped to one side. Tears filled his eyes, wet red hexagons swimming there, glistening. He blinked, and the tears slid free. The source of the light was finally visible. It wasn't a sign, after all, just the fading remnants of a fire left by some vagrant, or a wandering druid who'd sheltered here. No hope of help then, and no reprieve. He watched as the glowing wood brightened in a faint breeze, and a peaceful, aching sadness soaked into his heart as he realized he'd reached the end of his road. It hadn't felt nearly long enough. He turned his head and saw the man at the top of the steps. To Edric's dimmed eyes, he was little more than a shadow, but the red light reflected from his round spectacles and made him look infernal, an imp from the abyss come to carry him away. He was short and balding and wore a long black coat. When he spoke, his voice was breathy and damp, the sound of gentle murder. No more running. He stepped down into the light. He was fish-lipped, weak-eyed, with a pale, soft face and the look of a clerk about him. In other circumstances he might have appeared comical, but he had the double-barred cross on his shoulder, the hated symbol of the Iron Hand, and Edric didn't feel like laughing. "I am Overwatchman Clisson," he said. "Hail to the Emperor." Edric had dropped his sword on the temple steps, but he had a knife at his hip, which he drew and held before him. It was a feeble threat, and Clisson ignored it. "There will be others," Edric said. "Others like me, and we'll drive you from this land."
"The folk of Salt Fork did not share your conviction."
The overwatchman raised his head, taking in the gloomy grandeur of the temple.
"We have made your highways safe and swift, brought order to your cities, and given you the gift of the word and the sword. We protect you against enemies who would slaughter or enslave you. Your farmers enjoy the fruits of their fields. Your seamstresses sew in peace, and your children want to be Croden."
His tone became puzzled.
"When will you be satisfied?"
"We'll be satisfied when the last Croden is gone from our land, when your thrice-damned god is cast down and an Ossian sits on the throne again with the Ember Blade in their hand," said Edric. "We'll be satisfied when we have our freedom."
Clisson lowered his gaze, and the light made his spectacles red again.
"Ah, that you will never have, because in the deepest places where you dare not look, you know you are better off without it."
"One day you'll eat those words from the tip of an Ossian sword," he spat. "Kill me, if you're going to."
"You'll die, have no doubt of that. But first you'll talk. There is one among your companions I seek. You knew him as Lane of Heath Edge, but we both know that's not his real name."
Edric lay in silence for a few moments. Then he began to chuckle, a pained sound, almost like sobbing.
"He has evaded you."
"For now."
"Then hope is not lost."
"I wouldn't say that."
Clisson motioned with his hand, and three figures appeared at the top of the stairs, silhouetted by the light from the temple doorway. One was hulking and armoured, carrying a great hammer. Another was ragged and thin, holding a bow. The third was cowled and cloaked, with a gleam of metal where a face should have been. The sight of them was like a cold weight on Edric's chest. Here was the source of the nameless dread that had silenced the forest. It drained the courage from him, and fear made him babble.
"I can't tell you where he is. I don't know where he is."
He became aware of an itch in his knife hand, increasing to a burn. Something was writhing under his skin there, vile tunnelling worms that turned and coiled in the light of the dying fire. Horror and disgust choked him. His other hand flew to his face, where the skin had begun to blister, swell and ooze. "We'll see what you know," Clisson said quietly, as Edric finally found breath to scream. 2. The cave was a triangular maw filled with shadowed teeth. Aaron studied it warily, knuckles white where he gripped his sword. "You think she went in there?" Cade nodded from his hiding place, crouched behind a boulder, poised to flee. He had his knife in hand, but he clearly had little faith in it. Aaron glanced back in case their quarry had slipped around for an ambush. The green flanks of the ravine sloped steeply up to either side. At the top, sunlight slanted across the grass, but down here it was dimmer and the air was still. The ground was cluttered with rocks of all sizes, from pebbles to great boulders shaken loose by the march of ages, shaggy with moss and lichen. A shallow stream, ankle-deep and a few paces wide, splashed between them. Dank, scrawny trees drowsed nearby, with watchful crows in their branches. They heard a sharp clatter of tumbling stones from the cave. Cade sprang to his feet, ready to bolt. Aaron caught him by his shoulder and pressed him back down.
"It's her," Aaron whispered, half in triumph and half in terror.
Cade gave a low moan of despair. Heart thumping, breath short, Aaron stepped into the open and crept forward. When Cade showed no sign of moving, he scowled and gestured at him to follow. Cade slid out from behind the boulder, muttering darkly. They were no longer boys and not quite men, adults in their own minds and no one else's. Aaron was gangly but not tall, his body still finding its proportions. Cade had a heavier build, a clumsy, solid boy who moved without grace. Thick brown curls hung across Aaron's brow. He had soft eyes, a flat jaw, and a long wide nose that split his face like the shank of an anchor. Cade had small features in a fleshy frame, a quick restless mouth, and the first dusting of a beard, the same muddy blonde as his close-cut hair. It was Cade who'd glimpsed their quarry first. A rush of movement, a thrashing in the bracken, a flash of haunch. "Big as a bear," he told Aaron, when he got over the fright. "Just like Dara said she was." They'd tracked her into the ravine after that, and finally cornered her here. Aaron crept up to the mouth of the cave. Within was a chill grey world of hard angles. Nothing moved. He was about to go further when Cade grabbed his arm.
"You ain't actually going in?" he whispered incredulously. "Why don't we wait here?"
Aaron saw him struggle to think of a good reason.
"We can jump her when she comes out."
Aaron was tempted by the idea. Better to tackle the beast in daylight, where they could manoeuvre. But lurking in ambush felt cowardly. When Toven chased the Draken of King's Barrow into its lair and slew it, he didn't hide outside for hours first.
"No, we'll catch her unawares, where she can't escape from us," he said.
"Oh, aye, that's a great plan," Cade griped. "Foolproof. And what if we want to escape?"
Aaron went in, and the quiet gloom closed around him. He kept the stream to his left, moving in a low crouch, his sword held defensively across his body as Master Oryk had taught him. A splash and a string of curses told him that Cade had followed him inside, and that he now had at least one wet foot.
"She was like a wolf, but like no wolf you ever saw,
Dara had said, his eyes bright and earnest.
A she-warg, high as your shoulder, broad as a cart, teeth like daggers. I saw her walking through the trees in Sander's Wood.
My brother saw her too,
Maya had said.
Next day, three of my father's flock were gone, only blood and torn wool left to mark them.
Aaron tried not to think of the beast's size, or her teeth, or the fact he wasn't one-tenth the swordsman Tovan had been. Instead, he imagined the townsfolk cheering their return, the nods of respect from the Croden honour guard, the pride in his father's gaze as the governor praised them. Best of all would be the sight of Sora's delighted face when he presented her with the she-warg's paw, a hero's token to his lady. Ahead, the cave bent sharply to the right, and the way was obscured by a bulge in the rock. The light from the cave mouth was feeble this far back, and Aaron wished they'd thought to bring a lantern. Facing the beast in darkness wasn't something he'd anticipated. Perhaps an ambush did make sense. He'd always preferred the stories about clever Thomas to those of his mighty brother Tovan anyway. Thomas won through wit and craft rather than force of arms. But what if there was another way out of the cave? After all this time searching, he wasn't about to let the beast get away. Staying close to the cold rock, he peered round the bend and saw a small underground chamber beyond. There was a jagged fissure in one wall, wide enough to squeeze through. The stream ran across the chamber and away down another passage. Nothing moved but the restlessly tumbling water.
"How's it look?" Cade asked.
"Come and see," said Aaron, and stepped in. The darkness was pushed back by a thin shaft of daylight which cut diagonally across his path from a dripping hole in the ceiling. An assortment of slimy plants had found purchase along the stream's edge and glowed dimly there. He saw phosphor moss and riddle cap and other moulds and mushrooms he couldn't identify. Cade slunk in behind him.
"Don't much like the look of that horrible great crack in the wall," he said.
As if in reply, they heard a furtive rustle of movement from the fissure, the sound of something unmistakably alive. They turned to face it together with mounting dread.
"You know, I heard a tale about a cave hereabouts," Cade murmured. "A cave at the end of a ravine, with a little stream coming out of it. An old hermit lived there, rotten to the core, with a hook for a hand."
His voice dropped, and he leaned closer, eyes like saucers.
"More than one traveller took shelter in that cave on a rainy night and never came out. He hung them up like meat. Story goes he died alone and hateful, but his shade walks here still, and the last thing you'll hear before he gets you is his hook, scratching along the stone."
Aaron gave him a flat look.
"You just made that up so you can go home," he accused.
I did," said Cade, shrugging. "Worth a try."
He picked up a rock.
"Shall we see what's in there, then?"
"Not like that," Aaron began, but he was too late to stop Cade tossing the rock. A maelstrom of thrashing wings exploded from the fissure. Aaron yelled and swung his sword at the air as flapping creatures beat at his face. His blade clanged off stone and numbed his fingers, nearly jolting out of his grip. Cade capered about, slapping wildly at his own head, trying to dislodge a bat which had become tangled in his hair. Half-seen shapes darted past them, whirling in panicked circles, before flurrying away towards the entrance of the cave, leaving the two boys panting and gasping in fright. Cade rubbed his hands through his hair and looked at them in disgust.
"Flying rats! Ugh!"
He spotted Aaron leaning against the cave wall with his sword drawn.
"You get any?"
he asked dryly.
"Next time you think you have an idea, why don't you float it past me first?" Aaron said breathlessly.
"I ain't the one who just led us into a cave to face a she-warg without any lanterns."
"No,"
You're just the one who followed him in. From the passage they heard a splash of water and an animal snort that set them rigid. Well, reckon that's me done for the day, said Cade, heading off after the bats. Aaron grabbed him. No, you don't, he said, dragging Cade back to his side. Together they stared into the dark passage. Cade's fingers flexed nervously on his knife hilt, his expression dubious. Sure you don't want to go for a nail at the Cross Keys instead? Aaron slapped him on the back for encouragement. Cade rolled his eyes and tutted. Go on then, let's get this over with, but I ain't going first. Aaron had no intention of letting him. This beast was Aaron's to kill. It would make a poor tale for Sora otherwise. High as your shoulder, broad as a cart, teeth like daggers. They trod quietly as they followed the stream deeper into the cave. The blackness thickened, and they were forced to hunch over as the ceiling bore down on them. Just before they reached the limit of the light, they found a new passage leading off to the right. They heard another snort, loud and close enough that Aaron jerked back and held out an arm to bar Cade's way. The beast was right around the corner. Cade's eyes glittered with fear, and he grabbed Aaron's elbow, shaking his head. But Aaron gripped his friend's forearm firmly and stared hard at him. Now it came to it, there was no question of turning back. We strike together, he hissed. Cade wavered, but Aaron wouldn't let him go. We can do it, he said, and this time he saw reluctant determination settle on his friend's face. Aaron and Cade, he whispered with a reckless smile. They'll call us heroes. They'll call us something, that's for sure, Cade agreed grudgingly. Are you ready? On my word. Cade nodded, but not without a look that made plain what he thought of being dragged into this adventure. Aaron listened. There was another grunt, the sound of the beast moving. He drew a breath, held it for a moment, and then let out a cry as fierce as he could make it. They plunged round the corner, blades raised. Utter dark faced them. Utter dark, and no sign of their quarry. They faltered, not knowing where to strike, not daring to go onwards, and in that moment the beast was on them with a terrifying scream. Aaron and Cade stumbled back, sloshing into the stream as it charged. Aaron slipped on a wet rock, and his leg went out from under him. His head struck the wall, stars exploding before his eyes as he dropped to his hands and knees in the chill water. Pain sang from his shins and palms. Somehow, his sword had jarred free of his grip. He cast around frantically in the stream, but it was nowhere to be seen. He heard Cade shout a warning, and he was swatted by the beast's hot, bristly flank, its musty stink filling his nostrils. He tried to wrap his arms round it, to wrestle it down rather than let it batter him, but the beast bucked and skidded in the stream, slamming Aaron against the wall, its coarse fur scratching his face. Teeth gritted, he struggled to hold on to it. "Cade, stab it!" he yelled, though he couldn't see his friend through all the water splashing in his eyes. The beast kicked, catching him low and hard in his gut, and his arms came loose. A heavy haunch slammed into his cheek, and then the beast was away, charging downstream, grunting and squealing frantically. The sounds faded as it reached the freedom of the open air, leaving Aaron kneeling in the stream, bruised and winded, a dull ache in his belly and groin. "Aaron?" Cade hurried up to him. "Are you hurt?" He blinked dazedly, popped his eyes wide a few times to clear the fog in his head, then laboriously got to his feet. "Where's my sword?" "I don't know, you dropped it somewhere." "There it is, in the stream." Holding the back of his head with one hand, Aaron stooped to retrieve his weapon. His face felt hot, and not just from the battle. "That was no she-warg," he said at length. "That was a wild pig." "Looked like one," Cade said. Then, to make them both feel better, he added, "It was a really big wild pig." Aaron, sodden and dripping, saw the edges of Cade's mouth turn up, and that set him off. The two of them leaned on each other and laughed until tears streaked their cheeks. Eventually, Aaron showed signs of calming down, but then Cade oinked at him and they were away again. By the time they were done, Aaron's stomach hurt and Cade was in danger of fainting.
"Maybe best we don't tell anyone about this," Aaron suggested as they made their way out of the cave and into the sunlight.
Cade crouched by the stream, wadded up a rag from his pocket and soaked it in cold water.
"As if I would. They'd never let us forget it. Here, put this on your bump."
Aaron pressed the rag gratefully to the back of his skull. The laughing fit hadn't helped his headache much.
"So, what do you think? Next time we try the East Ridge?"
"You ain't still after that she-warg," Cade said, amazed. 4 times we've gone hunting for her now. That's every day I've had off work in the last 2 weeks. Can we at least explore the possibility that Dara's a liar and Maya's just gullible?"
"We'll explore that possibility," said Aaron, "right after we've explored the East Ridge."
"There ain't no she-warg," Cade cried.
"You give up too easily," Aaron said over his shoulder as he started to trudge up the ravine.
"Aye, and you don't give up at all."
3. Step, step, feint. Now parry, feint, thrust. Cade sat against the base of a dry stone wall, eyes closed and face turned up to the sun, content as a basking cat. Bees droned lazily nearby, and the breeze stirred the long grass of the meadow. In the dappled shade of a lone spreading oak, Aaron jabbed and darted at imaginary foes, practicing his sword drills.
"Are you even watching?" Aaron demanded. "I'm trying to teach you something."
Cade cracked one eye open to look at him. Aaron stood with a fist on one hip and his blade lowered, sweating in the heat. Beyond him, the fields spread down the hill to the coast, a patchwork of green and yellow, dotted with farmsteads and speckled with sheep and cows. From their vantage point, Cade could see the Robbers' Highway, snaking from the east, and the Cross Keys Inn on the outskirts of town, where he and Aaron had sucked down more than a few foaming ales under old Nab's indulgent eye. Shoal Point was a cluster of buildings along the coast, mostly hidden by a fold in the land. West of that, there was only ocean, glittering bright enough to dazzle.
"I've been thinking," Cade said at length.
"Have you now?"
"All this business with the she-warg. Do you reckon Sora even wants a dirty great wolf paw?"
Aaron made a quizzical noise.
Cade elaborated. "If you were the high-born daughter of a rich Croden family, wouldn't you want jewels and flowers and such? I'm just saying she might be less than thrilled when you hand her a dismembered piece of a recently dead animal with the stump all crusty with blood."
Aaron opened his mouth to make a sharp reply, then shut it again and frowned. The question hadn't occurred to him before now.
"Well, obviously I'll clean the blood off first," he said testily.
"It'll still smell pretty bad," Cade said.
"What's she going to do with it anyway? Wear it as a necklace? It'd put her back out if the beast's as big as we're told."
A sour look passed over Aaron's face.
"Do you want me to show you Master Oryk's new drills or not?"
Cade levered himself up, satisfied that they wouldn't be exploring the East Ridge on his next day off. Aaron handed him the sword. It felt heavier than usual, but that was probably because he was feeling lazy.
"Ain't it a bit hot for sword practice?" he tried half-heartedly.
"Stop complaining. Come autumn, I won't be here to teach you any more." Cade saddened at that, but he tried to make a joke of it.
"Just promise me you'll send me the paws of any mighty wargs you slay. I'll have them if Sora won't."
"Ha! Get to work, you layabout."
Cade let Aaron demonstrate the new moves again and copied them as best he could, but his mind wasn't on the task. As a high-born Ossian approaching his 16th birthday, Aaron would soon leave for his year's service with the Croden military. Cade, a carpenter's son, wouldn't be joining him.
Crodans didn't want working boys like Cade. They only cared about the sons of rich Ossians, who could be trained as loyal and useful servants of the Empire. He had other friends, but they were the children of bakers, potters, fishermen. None were like Aaron, who could speak fluent Crodan, who knew history and mathematics and etiquette, and had a permit to carry a sword, even if he had to keep it sheathed and wrapped within town limits. In truth, Cade was a little in awe of the high-born boy, and secretly dreaded the day Aaron realized he could do better than a dockside lad with little education and no particular skill in anything. The year ahead loomed large and empty. He feared it would be a different Aaron who returned, one he didn't know. He made a passable effort at sword practice, enough to show his appreciation, but it was exhausting in the heat, and he gave up as soon as he thought Aaron would let him. He didn't like the sword much, and he'd never be permitted to own one anyway, but Aaron always enjoyed showing off what he knew. "Maybe it is a bit hot for sword practice," said Aaron. "Do you want to learn some Crodan instead? I could teach you how to make a diminutive noun." "Why don't I tell you a tale instead?" Cade suggested, with an enthusiasm that verged on desperation. "I've got a new one. You'll like it." "Is it a Crodan story?" Aaron asked. "Naturally," Cade lied. "Do I tell you any other kind?" He wished his mother would tell him some Crodan stories sometimes, so that he could pass them on to Aaron, but though she had a bard's tongue, she refused to recite the legends of their oppressors. Aaron, on the other hand, loved anything Crodan, and said the old Ossian folk tales were for bumpkins. To get around the problem, Cade changed the names in his mother's tales and passed them off as Crodan. He suspected Aaron knew, but the deception let him enjoy the stories of his homeland without admitting it to himself. Aaron settled himself by the dry stone wall, while Cade launched into the tale of Haldric, renamed Lord Merrick, and his companion Bumbleweed. It began with the hapless pair stumbling across a maiden bathing naked in a rock pool, a woman so fair she stole Lord Merrick's heart. But clumsy Bumbleweed stepped on a twig with a loud snap, and the alarmed maiden melted away as if by magic before Lord Merrick could introduce himself. Against his companion's advice, Lord Merrick decided he had to find the maiden and marry her. So they went to see an old woman, who told him that the maiden was the daughter of a kraken, and she only walked the earth one day every 10 summers, spending the rest beneath the sea. Lord Merrick wasn't of a mind to wait 10 years for another glimpse of her creamy skin, so they set off in search of her, finally reaching Johur's River in the sky, recast as a magic stream so as not to give the game away, where they learned to breathe water from a fish with scales of fire. Suitably prepared, they descended to the depths of the sea, where Lord Merrick challenged the kraken to a battle of wits, ably assisted by Bumbleweed, who'd happened upon all the answers to the kraken's riddles during their journey. When Lord Merrick won, he claimed the right to ask the kraken's daughter for her hand in marriage. The kraken granted his boon, but his daughter promptly refused, asking why she should marry a man who made a habit of spying on naked women in rock pools. Aaron howled with laughter as Cade aped Lord Merrick and Bumbleweed trudging dejectedly from the sea onto the shore, and cheered when Lord Merrick swore off women forever and promised eternal friendship to Bumbleweed, who'd supported him faithfully through all his adventures. "Your best yet," Aaron said when he was done, and Cade glowed, though he knew it was flattery, and bowed. Then he shaded his eyes and looked towards the sun. "Best be getting on," he said. "I have to be home for supper, and Dad will tan my hide if I miss it again." "All things can wait but supper and lovers," Aaron quoted happily as he got to his feet. "That's an Ossian proverb," Cade said. "Bumpkin." Aaron shoved him down the hill. 4. By a wooded path on the edge of town stood an old boundary stone, weathered to a nub. There they paused while Aaron wrapped his sword and scabbard tightly in burlap cloth. "I'll bet you can't wait till you don't have to do that anymore," Cade observed. He was sitting on the boundary stone, tapping his heels against it and patting a rhythm with his hands. "When I get back from my service, they'll have to give me a full permit," Aaron said. It galled him to see the sons of Croden Highborns swanning about Shoal Point with their swords on display. He wouldn't feel a man till he could match them. Cade drew his knife from his belt, the blade he used for whittling and cutting his meat, and studied it without enthusiasm. "Reckon I'll have to make do with this," he tutted. "It'd be easier if we could all carry swords like before the Crodens came." "Are you joking? You know what it was like back then. Drunken sword fights in the street, armed gangs in the alleyways, bandits on the road. It's not called the Robber's Highway for nothing. It was lawless." "That ain't how my dad remembers it," said Cade. Aaron gave him a warning glance. "Then he'd best be careful who he remembers it to." He stood and secured his bound-up sword across his back with a strap. "Ossians are too hot-blooded," he said, matter-of-factly. "We don't have the discipline the Crodens do." "In other words, we can't be trusted." Aaron frowned. He didn't like it when Cade talked like that. It was dangerously close to sedition, which made him nervous. If you didn't report sedition, you were part of it. "Come on," he said, walking off up the lane. Cade sheathed his knife, slapped his thighs, slid off the boundary stone and followed. The town square was filling up for the evening. Families gathered round tables in a smiling jumble of hugs and hails, kisses and backslaps. Lanterns were being lit against the coming dusk, and a cool breeze carried away the heat of the day. Ropes of bunting and sheaves of shadowbane had been hung overhead, and children wearing spooky masks dodged and chased each other across the cobbles, while old men watched from benches, smoking pipes and drinking beer from leather jacks. There was celebration in the air, and with good reason. The fishermen had spotted hull whales breaching off Gabba's bank. The ghost tide was on its way, and the festival began tonight. "There's a mummer's troop coming to town," Cade exclaimed. He was studying the crier's board, where the town notices were posted. "Hmm?" Aaron was only half listening, scanning the crowd in the faint hope of seeing Sora. As usual, it was only Ossians who thronged the tables. His countrymen liked to dine in numbers and raucously. Respectable Croden families ate at home, where it was possible to hear one another. "Mummers," Cade said again. He squinted in concentration, mouthing the words as he read them. "They're doing pod and the pot of plenty." Aaron gave him a look. "It's hardly Brecken and Callihorn, is it?" "Dunno. What's breakfast and Calliwat?" "Rintha's masterwork about two feuding brothers," Aaron said, but all he got was a blank look. "Rintha? Croda's greatest playwright?" When Cade still didn't know what he was talking about, Aaron gave up. "He's famous," he said. "Ain't that famous, apparently," Cade said. He caught sight of someone over Aaron's shoulder. "There's Maya and Astra." They crossed the square. Maya was loafing against a low stone wall, watching the festivities with lazy-lidded eyes, a shock of frizzy brown curls framing her calm face. Astra sat on the wall, long straight hair tucked behind one ear, scratching at a wafer of paperwood with a stick of charcoal. "Aaron and Cade, Vaspis be my witness," said Maya as they approached. She liked to invoke the malcontent whenever she could. He, of all the nine aspects, was her god of choice. Aaron thought she was just doing it for the shock value. "Dara was sure you'd be devoured by now. Still after that she-warg?" "We're in more danger from heatstroke than from any she-warg," Cade said. "Well, let us know if you find it. Astra's keen to get a sketch." Astra looked up at the mention of her name, only now noticing the boys. Cade had a habit of falling in and out of infatuations, and Astra was his latest. Aaron could always tell, because he smiled wider than normal at them, which was unfortunate, as it made him look simple. "What are you drawing?" he asked. She tipped the wafer of wood to show him. There was a large dragonfly pinned to one side, next to its likeness in charcoal.
"That's really good," said Cade, and grinned wider, progressing from simple to witless.
Astra went back to her work, barely acknowledging the compliment.
"Going to see the ghost tide tonight?"
Maya asked Aaron. He grinned.
"The torments themselves couldn't stop me."
"Really?
I heard your dad was funny about letting you out after dark."
"Where'd you hear that?" Aaron said, as if the whole idea was preposterous rather than embarrassingly true. She shrugged.
"Heard it around."
"Well, it's a lie."
"I'll be there. You can count on it,"
he told her confidently.
And he meant to be, assuming he could get past the servants. But he had a plan in mind for that.
Maya looked over at Cade.
"You going too?"
"Oh, I don't reckon I will," said Cade, affecting nonchalance. "Need to be up early to help in the workshop." He glanced at Aaron and away, and Aaron felt a stab of guilt. Cade wanted to go with him tonight, and without Aaron he'd likely just mope at home. But there were some things even a best friend couldn't be part of. They said their goodbyes and headed away from the square. Aaron didn't take the most direct route, preferring to detour past the towering temple, which rose above the roofs of Shoal Point a few streets away. If he was lucky, the priests would still be at evensong, and he'd catch the end.
"I need to be back for supper soon,"
Cade protested, guessing where they were going.
"We won't be long, just passing by."
"You never just pass by." They emerged into a small cobbled plaza in front of the temple. Aaron slowed to a halt and let his gaze travel up the facade. No matter how many times he saw it, his sense of awe never waned. The stern imposing lines, bold geometric forms and strict symmetry spoke of strength, order and discipline. It came from another world than the narrow, winding sandstone alleys which surrounded it, buildings piled up higgledy-piggledy with their plaster cracked by salt and sun, joined by uneven steps and crowded passageways. An old temple to the Nine had stood there once, but it had been torn down and replaced when Aaron was young. Like all Croden temples, it had two entrances, representing the two routes to the Primus's light. Above each, standing in an alcove, was a statue. One was a young man in robes, his face serene, an open book in one hand. The other was armoured, staring boldly out across the plaza, hands folded on the pommel of a sword, resting point down between his feet. Scholarly Thomas and brave Toven, the word and the sword, earthly champions of the Primus.
"I'm noticing a marked lack of just passing by and a sight more stopping and gawping," Cade grouched.
Aaron ignored him. As he'd hoped, the priests were still singing. Their voices drifted hauntingly across the plaza, echoing and reverberant, a net of harmonies, mystifying in their complexity. High voices soared above the tide of sound like gulls on the wind. Then the basses rolled in, and the hymn swelled till it filled the sky. It was music of dazzling craft, and Aaron found himself caught in its spell. Ossia had no music like it. Only a few great works had survived the fall of the Second Empire, and they were dated now and rarely played. His people favoured folk song to formal music, tunes for the inn and the campfire, sometimes bawdy and sometimes elegiac, but always intimate and inclusive. Aaron couldn't deny they had a certain primitive power, that they tunnelled into his heart when he'd had a few drinks, and conjured a yearning for times he'd never lived through, but they were childish compared to Croden symphonies.
"Oh, Nine, they're at their bloody yowlin' again," said Cade, rolling his eyes.
Aaron suppressed a scowl of irritation. Cade worshipped the Nine, and liked music he could clap and stamp along to. Aaron influenced him in most things, but despite his best efforts, Cade had never shown the slightest sign of changing his mind about that.
Young Aaron, you're a little early for convocation. 5 days early, in fact.
It was Predicant Irvin, hailing him from one of the doorways at the top of the temple steps. He was an elderly priest, popular in the town for his light heart and easy manner. He wore beige and red robes, beige for parchment and red for blood, stitched with Croden rays across the shoulder and chest. On a chain around his neck hung the sign of the Sanctorum, the blade and the open book, wrought in gold.
"I just wanted to hear the evensong," Aaron called back. "Are you not joining in?"
"Alas, the Primus saw fit to give me the voice of a bullfrog with a mouthful of wasps. I fend off the nemesis in other ways."
He brandished a twig broom.
"By sweeping the steps, for example. Noble work if you can get it."
"We all do our part," Aaron said with a grin.
He noticed Cade edging anxiously towards the plaza's exit.
"But we should go. Even the Primus won't save Cade if he's not back for supper."
"I'll see you both on Festen Day," said Predicant Irvin, raising a bony hand in farewell.
"Still don't see why I have to go to convocation," Cade grumbled as they hurried away. "I don't even believe in that stuff, nor do half the Ossians in Shoal Point."
"Maybe they're hoping that one day you will," Cade snorted. They left the plaza and walked along the flagstones of Fishmonger's Way. The shops were shuttered today, and there was no market, but the beer hall rang with Croden voices singing the anthems of their homeland. Dim, distorted figures raised their tankards behind panes of bullseye glass. A wooden sign hung over the doorway, depicting two fighting falcons, the emblem of the Anval Brewery, advertising thick, dark beer from the heart of the Empire. Two soldiers stood guard outside, clad in Croden black and white, their grim faces made statuesque by their distinctive angular helmets. At the end of Fishmonger's Way, a knot of lanes and tiny plazas ran along the edge of the western cliffs, descending steadily towards the docks, beaches and coves beyond. Here were the hole-in-the-wall bakeries that sold morning rolls and pastries, single-room bars hidden upstairs behind rusty gates, crushed-together houses with sagging eaves where cats groomed themselves on tiny sills. To their left, gaps between the houses revealed a peaceful blue sea, the sun bald and red on the horizon. Aaron grinned. The sun couldn't fall fast enough today. When night came, the adventure would begin.
"Aaron!"
His smile faded as he looked back up the alley. Standing at the corner were two young men. One was corn blonde, handsome and athletically built, the Croden dream of vigour and poise. The other was less well-favoured, with a long pointed nose, pitted skin and ruddy hair. Harald and Duke, Sora's elder brothers.
"Still loafing about with the carpenter's boy, I see," Harald said. "I'm glad you're keeping company that befits your station. It's a habit you'd do well to nurture."
Aaron thought of a dozen insulting replies and said none of them.
"What do you want, Harald?"
The two Crodans sauntered up the alley. They were dressed in fine waistcoats and embroidered trousers, and narrow swords hung at their hips. By their attitude, they meant trouble.
"Do you remember what I said last time we spoke?" said Harald. "I think you do. I feel we were very clear, even allowing for the remarkable dull-wittedness of you people."
Aaron felt angry heat rise up from his chest. It was an effort to remain polite.
"You told me to stay away from Sora," he said. "You did understand," Harald said. "And that wasn't your first warning either. In fact, you've had several. Our father even visited yours to make his feelings clear."
Aaron said nothing, but he held Harold's gaze steadily, which was as much defiance as he dared. Duke turned a disdainful eye on Cade, as if noticing him for the first time.
"Run along, eel sucker. This doesn't concern you."
Cade glanced at Aaron, then back at Duke. He didn't move, though his feet shuffled as if he dearly wanted to.
"Are you deaf?" Duke asked.
"I can stand where I like," Cade mumbled.
"Say your piece, Harold," Aaron said, bringing their attention back to him.
Duke gave Cade a dangerous glare, but was content with that for now.
"What can I say that will make you listen?" Harold said helplessly.
"Has it escaped your notice that you're Ossian, while she is Croden and cousin to a count? She may not have the sense to look after her own reputation, but it is our responsibility to see that she remains marriageable, and if you ruin her, Aaron, then I will be honour-bound to kill you, and neither of us wants that."
He cocked his head and sighed. "I can only assume you find it all a little too complicated to grasp, so let me boil it down for you."
He leaned in close and dropped his voice to a menacing whisper.
"You will never have her," he said,
and shoved Aaron in the chest so forcefully that he tripped over backwards and landed hard on the rough ground, skinning his elbows, his wrapped sword jarring against his spine. Duke brayed with laughter as Aaron scrambled back to his feet, teeth gritted and face flushed. He desperately wanted to plant a fist in Harold's supercilious mouth. They were both bigger and stronger than him, and they'd beat him hard, but it would be worth it to split that lip. A lifetime of ingrained restraint stopped him. He was Ossian, and they were Croden. If anyone reported it, the punishment would be severe.
"You'd love to strike me, wouldn't you?" Harold said with a smile. "Look at you, clenching your fists. You people solve everything with violence. Luckily for you, we are more civilized."
He drew a folded letter from his breast pocket, its wax seal broken.
"We found this in her room. She never was very good at hiding things."
Aaron's stomach dropped as he recognized the letter.
"Give me that."
"That's not going to happen," said Harold dismissively. "However, we will give it to our father, if we ever suspect you've met with Sora again. He has the governor's ear, as you know. I wonder what will happen to your father when the governor learns he failed to restrain you."
"That's mine."
Aaron could barely force the words through a throat thick with humiliation and rage.
"It's private."
"Not anymore. Not when it concerns my family." He handed the paper to Duke, who unfolded it.
"Perhaps your friend would like to hear some." "Sora, my love, my only love," Duke began, trilling in parody of a tortured romantic.
"Just one punch, just one." But his body wouldn't respond. He could walk into a cave to face a she-warg, but he couldn't hit a Croden. Everything in his life had trained him against it.
"Stop it," he demanded, and was appalled by how pathetic he sounded.
Cade looked like he wished he could be anywhere else.
"To be apart from you is agony," Duke continued, holding the back of his hand to his forehead and wilting. "I must..."
He stopped and snorted.
"You missed the accent over agony. If you have to write in Croden, learn to do it properly."
He resumed.
"I must see you, my darling. It burns my..."
"Enough," Aaron shrieked. Duke looked to Harold, asking with his gaze if he should go on. Harold stared at Aaron coolly. "I think we've made our point." Aaron nodded, biting his lower lip. Duke folded up the letter and handed it back to Harold, who slipped it into his breast pocket and patted it. Aaron stood slump-shouldered, looking anywhere but at his tormentors. "Find yourself a nice Ossian girl," said Harold, with unexpected gentleness. "I know you love her, but it will pass. My sister's not for you." He clapped Duke on the shoulder and they turned to go.
"No more warnings, Aaron,"
he called as they left. Once they were out of sight, he became conscious of Cade eyeing him awkwardly.
"You all right?" Cade asked.
Aaron bit back a sharp reply.
He wanted to take out his feelings on someone, and Cade was an easy target, but it wouldn't be the right thing to do. "I think I'll just head home," he said. Without further words of parting, he walked away. Bravery loved company, but Aaron had long ago learned that shame was best borne alone. 5.
"There's my boy, and not a moment too soon. Set the table, supper's ready."
Cade did as his ma told him, laying out bowls, spoons, and leather drinking jacks. Between the table and the stove, there was little room to move in the kitchen, but they slid around each other with practiced ease. The dusk leaked in through sheaves of green herbs hanging over the window, and the air was damp with steam and rich with the smell of rabbit stew. Walls of bare, uneven brick and cracked mortar were hidden by cluttered shelves, racks of spices, and pans on hooks. It was hot and close and dim, and it was Cade's favourite room in the house. To be in Velda's kitchen while she was cooking was to be a leaf caught in a storm, sent flurrying here and there, never able to settle till the tempest was over. His da avoided the room for that reason, but Cade liked to help. He enjoyed cooking, and he made an eager apprentice. While they braised and mashed and chopped, she told him stories, and sometimes had him tell some of his own. After a long day in the workshop with his da, it was always a relief to do something he was good at. Velda bustled past him and ladled out the stew, hollering his da's name as she did so. She was a tough, round woman, tanned and salted by coastal life, who sold oysters on the docks. Her eyes were creased and kindly, her greying hair bound up in a kerchief, and despite her increasing years, she was as bright and busy as a field mouse. "Sit, sit," she urged him, and placed a round loaf of warm black bread on the table, wrapped in a checkered cloth. He took his spot on the bench as Baal came in from the back, a broad-chested man with a broken nose and a thick, tangled beard.
"Son," he slapped a heavy hand down on Cade's shoulder, "where did you get to today?"
"I was hunting that she-warg with Aaron again."
"Mm-hmm,"
he murmured absently. His gaze skipped over Cade to his wife. He put an arm around her waist, kissed her quickly on the cheek, and sat down.
"Rabbit stew,"
he said with great satisfaction, betraying the real focus of his attention. Velda gave Cade a smile as she poured weak ale from a jug. She'd heard him and approved. She believed boys should have adventures while they could.
"Thanks be to Hallen, Aspect of Plenty, for this bounty," Velda said once she was seated. "The Nine protect this house."
They set to the meal, tearing up the bread and spooning stew into their mouths. Cade sought out tender chunks of rabbit among the potatoes and vegetables, and sopped up the thick, peppery stew with his bread, softening the hard crust before he crunched it down. He found a wonderful stillness in the midst of a hearty meal. He felt centred, entirely in the moment, his mind clear of thought. For that brief time, there was no need to speak, and no one expected a thing of him.
"Good, good,"
Baal rumbled to himself when he was done. He sat back and took a pull of ale. Cade could tell he'd had plenty already by the glaze in his eyes and the slow way he moved. It was Jaws Day, which meant he'd likely spent his day off in Finnan's tiny bar by the docks, drinking with the fishermen.
"Squarehead farmer up in the hills wants a wardrobe making," Baal said, and burped. "Croden style. Ossian furniture ain't good enough for that lot."
He took another pull and set his ale down.
"That used to be Arol's farm before they took it from him," he added bitterly.
Then he looked at Cade.
"We'll set to it on the morrow. I will show you how to make duck beak joints the way the squareheads like. You can mix up the varnish."
Cade nodded and kept eating. He didn't want to think about tomorrow, about sanding and hammering, chisels and saws, splines and splinters. He had his ma's head for stories and her clever tongue, but his hands were hooves and there was none of Dar's craft in him. No matter how carefully Baal taught him, he never got it right, Baal wasn't a patient man, but he was a persistent one. Every day he tried anew to make his son a carpenter, and every day Cade disappointed him. If Cade had a brother, things might have been different. But he'd almost killed his ma as she pushed him out, a fact Baal never tired of mentioning, sometimes in jest, sometimes not. And Baal loved his wife too much to risk another child. So there was only Cade, and when the time came, he'd have to take over the business, and that was how it was. "There's a mummer's troop coming to town for the ghost tide," Cade said. "It was on the crier's board. We could go and see them. After we're finished in the workshop, I mean."
"That's a fine idea," Velda enthused.
"As long as they aren't sards," said Baal. "I won't stand to watch sards, filthy folk. If they ain't trying to sell you something that's broke, they're picking your pocket."
"I don't reckon they're sards," Cade said uncertainly. "It's an Ossian play, Pod and the Pot of Plenty."
"Oh, I like that one," his ma said.
Baal harumphed, swigged his ale and said nothing.
"Aaron says that mummer's troops sometimes hire a carpenter to travel with them," Cade said tentatively. "To build and repair the stage, make props and such. Easy stuff. The carpenter gets to be in the play, too. Everyone in the troupe has to act. Sometimes they play the lead, even."
"Mm-hmm."
Cade looked down at his hands where he was knotting his fingers.
I thought, well, I reckon it might be good experience for me, to really help me get a grasp of the basics. And I can make people laugh, I'm good at that. They might take me with them if I asked, just for a few weeks."
Baal was silent. He took another slow drink, his eyes far away and full of thought. Cade glanced at his ma, who made an encouraging face. Da appeared to be considering what he'd said. Cade let himself hope, just a little.
"And another thing about sards," Baal snapped. "They're so cursed secretive. Stick to their own, don't they? Whisperin' in their secret tongue. That ain't how honest people act. We should kick them all out, that's my view on it. This ain't even their country."
Cade's heart sank, and his gaze dropped to the table. His da hadn't even heard him. Cade had no love for sards either, but in some ways he envied them. They were the landless, roamers who were unwelcome wherever they settled, but at least they were free to forge their own fates. He dreamed of the world beyond the walls of his da's gloomy workshop, a life where the weeks and years were not already laid out before him, somewhere he counted for something. But it was a fool's dream. He was a carpenter's son, and that was all he'd ever be. So the world turned.
"Cavan called, boy, looking for you," Baal said. "You never go about with that boy any more."
"I was with Aaron," said Cade.
"Hunting she-wargs," added Velda with a glimmer in her eye.
"I wish you wouldn't go trailing around after that boy like a lost puppy," Baal grumbled.
"I ain't trailing round after anyone," said Cade, roused to indignation. "He's my friend."
"Aye, until he's not," said Baal, sucking down the last of his ale. "He's his father's son, and the apple don't fall far from the tree. Disloyalty's in his blood. Only one way an Ossian gets to be rich in this day and age."
"Baal," Velda warned.
"I'll speak my mind at my own table," he said. "And I call Randall a turncoat, lickspittle, collaborator, just like all the rest who rolled over when the Crodans came, desperate to keep what they had."
Velda pointed a stern finger at Cade.
"You ain't to repeat that outside this room, not even to Aaron, especially not to Aaron."
"I ain't stupid, Ma," said Cade,
for whom the whole thing was a lot less serious than his parents seemed to think it was.
"And you," Velda snapped at Baal, "you hold your tongue. You want to bring the Iron Hand down on us?"
"Should I fear spies in my own house?" Baal crowed. "Hiding in the stew pot, perhaps?"
Made smug by his own wit, he put his jack to his mouth and looked faintly puzzled when he found it empty.
"Not here," said Velda, But loose words breed loose words, and when beer makes you bold, you're apt to say what you're thinking. One day you'll say it to the wrong person, and who'll run your workshop then?
Baal scowled at that, but he didn't argue. He held out his jack, and Velda filled it, satisfied that he'd got the message.
"That boy's a Croden lover, and he's the son of a Croden lover," Baal said darkly. "Mixing with his sort will only bring you trouble. Heed that, boy."
"Aye, da," said Cade. But he didn't. After all, his da had never taken heed of him.
6. Aaron leaned forward, his brow furrowed, hand covering his mouth, deep in thought. Master Fasson, seated opposite, watched him keenly, awaiting his next move. Between them, on the castle's board, two armies waged war. The hexagonal board was divided into hundreds of smaller hexes, across which dozens of carved pieces were scattered, some of ivory and some of polished black stone. The castles, which gave the game its name, were unevenly placed around the board. The object was to capture and hold them while protecting your king. A broken line of blue counters, representing a river and its fords, meandered between them. Aaron's eyes flickered over the battlefield. He held two castles and had made gains by capturing a ford with a pair of giants. Master Fasson held the other four castles and was steadily pounding Aaron's left flank with superior numbers. It didn't look good. Aaron picked up a swordsman and advanced it two hexes into enemy territory. The moment he released the piece, Master Fasson slid an archer into firing range and took it.
"You didn't think that through, Aaron," he chided.
Aaron's tutor was a gaunt man, straight-backed despite his age, sober in dress and manner. He had large ears and a beak of a nose, a bare pate, bushy white sideburns, and a solemn dignity that Aaron thought particularly Croden.
"Perhaps I should reconsider my strategy," Aaron said. He sat back, regarding the board as if it were a puzzle he couldn't solve.
Night was thickening outside, the hedgerows and lawns silvered by starlight. Aaron could hear the tinkle and rattle of the servants cleaning up in the dining room. Soon they'd be in to draw the parlour curtains and trim the lamps. The hour after supper was for digestion and relaxation, when members of the household and their guests would gather for games, music and conversation. Nanny Alsa and Master Oric had also joined them tonight. She was embroidering a handkerchief, and he was sitting in an armchair, drinking a glass of dark brandy and smoking a thin cheroot. Aaron picked up an ivory draken, weighed it in his hand and mind, then flew it over the river to take one of Master Fasson's swordsmen. His opponent raised an eyebrow and slid a black knight through a gap in his lines to bump up against Aaron's draken. Aaron tutted as the piece was removed.
"You must think three moves ahead," Master Fasson advised. "Know your intention before you act."
Aaron sat back again and made a show of thinking to satisfy the master. Everything was a test with Master Fasson, everything a lesson. But Aaron's mind wasn't on the game, and he suspected his opponent knew it. He was thinking of tonight, of the first night of the ghost tide. He was planning his escape. Master Oric cleared his throat in an unsuccessful attempt to draw Nanny Elsa's attention away from her needlework. He didn't live at the house, but was often to be found here, and his interest in Aaron's governess was evident to everyone except Nanny Elsa.
"Does your cheroot not agree with you, Master Oric?" Aaron inquired innocently.
"Oh, it's quite fine," said Master Oric, with a look that said Aaron would suffer at practice tomorrow. A dry throat, that's all."
He sipped his brandy, glaring at his pupil. Nanny Elsa never raised her head, but Aaron saw a hint of a smile on her lips. She was pretty and apple-cheeked, with strawberry blonde hair worn in buns over her ears. She'd cared for him since he was 10, after his previous nanny departed suddenly for reasons nobody had ever properly explained to him.
He sensed there was a scandal there, but didn't care enough to pry, as he'd never liked her much. Nanny Elsa, by contrast, was all he could wish for in a surrogate mother. She was sweet and playful and loving, permissive when she should be and strict when necessary. She'd never raised her voice to him, as her disappointment was enough to shame him if he misbehaved. There was something in her manner that made people want to please her. She was liked by all and loved by some, but in the 5 years Aaron had known her, he'd never seen any sign that she was interested in romance, which made Master Oryk's plight all the more amusing. Aaron picked up one of his giants and sent it stamping across the castle's board. Master Fasson moved to counter the danger, and Aaron slipped an assassin over the ford. Master Fasson shifted a trebuchet to one of the raised hexes that indicated high ground. Doing so increased its range and put Aaron's giant within reach. Master Fasson plucked the giant from the board.
"You are throwing your pieces away now," said Master Fasson disapprovingly. "This is very unlike you."
Master Oryk, restless and bored, got to his feet and went to the decanter to refill his brandy. He moved with a slight limp, the result of a leg wound sustained in the Croden army. He still dressed like an officer, his jacket neat, trousers pressed, and shoes shined, but he could no longer be one. Instead, he taught swordplay to the sons of the rich, and his regret over his lost past was evident in the amount he drank and smoked. Though young, his face was ruddy behind his red moustaches. He poured himself a new glass and straightened.
"Miss Elsa, if I might observe, you've been unusually quiet tonight and full of sighs," he announced, abandoning subtlety entirely. "Are you troubled?"
She put down her needlework and sighed again as if to prove his point.
"Your inquiry is kind, but it is nothing."
She spoke in Croden. It was the language of the household, and everyone here was Croden except Aaron. Only the servants spoke Ossian, though Aaron and his father sometimes did when they were alone. Randall had only learned the language of their occupiers after the invasion, and even 30 years later he still found his mother tongue easier. Aaron moved a piece. Master Fasson took it, and Aaron cursed, drawing a scowl from his opponent. He raised a hand in apology.
"Please, Miss Elsa, if you would speak of it, perhaps I could help," Master Oryk persisted.
"It is not a thing that can be helped," she replied sadly. "I grieve on a friend's behalf. I suppose you've heard of the recent events at Salt Fork?"
Aaron's ears pricked up at that. Salt Fork had been the subject of hot debate among the locals ever since the news reached Shoal Point. Ossian rebels had seized a fortified town that stood at the junction where the millflow joined the River Apsel. It was a vital link for river traffic, and for a time they'd snarled up transport in the region. Some thought them heroes, others called them mud-headed fools who threatened to bring the wrath of the Crodens down on them all. Aaron had been following the news with particular interest because his father was travelling in that region and he'd been due back days ago. There had been no word to explain the delay, but that wasn't unusual. Likely he was simply held up by the chaos surrounding the uprising, but Aaron couldn't shake the niggling worry that something worse had befallen him.
"Surely Salt Fork is a cause for joy, not grief," Master Oryk said. "The rebels were crushed entirely."
"By the grace of the Primus," Master Fasson added piously.
"His will be done," Aaron muttered in automatic response.
"I am glad of the victory," said Nanny Elsa, "but I grieve at the cost. Rosa, the chandler's wife, is a dear friend to me. Her son was at Salt Fork."
"A rebel?"
Master Oryk sounded disturbed. She shook her head.
"A notary. But he lived in the town, and he was part of what happened. The Iron Hand have made an example of the mayor and the town's leaders for going along with the rebels. Now they are questioning even minor officials, seeking guilt. Rosa fears her son will be among those punished. He is Ossian. There will be no mercy."
"Your generous heart does you credit, Miss Elsa," said Master Oryk. "But you need not grieve. If he is innocent, he has nothing to fear."
and if he collaborated, he is not worth your tears," Master Fasten said sternly.
Nanny Elsa picked up her needle again. "You are right, of course," she said quietly.
Aaron used his last giant to capture a swordsman. Master Fasten moved another piece to flank the giant, thereby preventing it from moving. Aaron deployed a knight to try to free it up, but Master Fasten managed to take the giant first. Aaron tried to move his knight from danger, but Master Fasten intercepted it with his queen.
"A truly disastrous assault," Master Fasten observed. "You have lost almost all your major pieces. Perhaps you would like to concede?"
"Not just yet," said Aaron. He slid his assassin through the hole where Master Fasten's queen had stood, tapped it against the Black King, and won the game. Master Fasten stared at the board in outraged astonishment, then up at his pupil. Aaron grinned. "There is no victory without sacrifice, Master." The master was still searching for a sufficiently tart reply when they heard hooves clopping in the lane, and Aaron surged to his feet. Horses approaching at this hour could only mean one thing.
"Father!"
He hurried out of the parlour, through wood-panelled corridors, past paintings and busts of Croden thinkers and generals. The servants were already preparing for the new arrivals as he scampered through the door onto the grand stone porch and down the steps to the forecourt. Two horsemen were dismounting in the moth-haunted lantern light, one rangy and tall, the other broad-shouldered and squat. Randall and his Brunlander bodyguard, Kern. Randall heard Aaron coming and turned to meet him with open arms. Aaron crashed into his father and held himself there, to his warmth and wiry strength, breathing in the sweat and leather smell of him. It was a greeting of Ossian passion rather than stout Croden reserve, the uncouth embrace of a peasant. But in that moment Aaron didn't care. Father was home.
7.
Randall's arrival sent the servants into a frenzy. The ostler and his daughter hurried to see to the horses. Maids stoked fires to heat water for baths. Most frantic of all was the kitchen, where the cook boys ran hither and thither, in and out of the pantry, while the cook loudly bemoaned the lack of notice. A boy was dispatched to town with orders to get more bacon for the next day's breakfast, even if he had to wake the butcher to do it. When Randall was away, the house felt empty. His return filled the rooms with warmth. He'd barely entered before his steward assaulted him with a flurry of pressing matters that needed his attention, but he brushed them off and slung an arm around his son.
"There's nothing so urgent it can't wait till the morrow," he said.
He winked at Aaron.
"Or at least till I've reached the bottom of a goblet of wine."
Taking the hint, a servant hurried off to uncork a bottle of Carthanian red. Randall headed for the dining room, nodding at the greetings from his household staff, Aaron grinning at his side. Kern loped behind them, scowling.
"And what of you, eh, my boy?" Randall asked. "Getting into trouble, no doubt."
"Nothing anyone's found out about," Aaron said brightly. Randall's laughter echoed down the corridor.